This week on the River Avenue Blues podcast, the return of Mike Axisa. We'd sit down and talk about Michael Pineda and the rest of the rotation, plus an interview with Keith Law, and we talked to Tommy Ransell about the upcoming Rays series. Welcome back to another River Avenue Blues podcast. Today, we welcome the triumphant return of Mike Axisa. Mike, how's it feel to be off the DL?
It feels great. I'm finally free to talk as much as I want now.
Yes, so we can kind of dig into this. And as we record, the Yankees are still in the middle of the second game of the series against the Mariners, which doesn't give us much of a chance to really wrap much up other than a less than optimal, we'll say, game on Tuesday.
Yeah, I mean, Tuesday's game was a bit of a mess, and I mean, that kind of stuff just happens, so, you know, it's, you just kind of brush it off and move on. And the Yankees had, you know, they had Monday off, they had Wednesday off because of the rain out, so they haven't played a whole lot recently, and, you know, I guess you take the rest when you can get it, you don't really complain too much.
Yeah, and you know, you wish they would have tried to get a doubleheader in today just because you don't want, you have to find the common off day otherwise. But I guess the rain was so bad yesterday that they didn't want to, you know, try to schedule two today and then get there at 1 o'clock and say, hey, we can't play this game.
Yeah, and that, and also the Mariners have a doubleheader next week already scheduled.
Oh, okay.
And I think it's on Wednesday next week, and they didn't want to have two doubleheaders in the span of
6 days. That would have been terrible.
Span of 6 days, and I mean, the good thing about the rainout is the Mariners have to come to New York to make the game up. The Yankees don't have to travel anywhere, and the day they pick, June 2nd, it's like, it's one of those weird off days in the middle of a homestand, so the Yankees are going to be already there. It's no big deal, and I mean, it's just kind of the way it goes. You hate to lose the off day, but
yeah, but I like the way, I like this, the proactive scheduling, rather than saying, oh, we'll get an off day in September to do it, you know? Even with division games, I am a fan of making the games up as quickly as possible, rather than waiting until September. Which it seems like it's been happening less and less. It seems like, you know, 3-4 years ago, they used to make up we'll just wait till September to make it up. And in the last couple of years, it seems like they've been trying to do them as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and this year, I just looked at the schedule a day or two ago. The Yankees, to close out the season, they played 20 games in 20 days, which is, I mean, not ideal because you'd like to have some built-in rest there for the relievers, but
usually don't see that to close the season though. Usually teams usually get pretty good September rest.
Yeah, so that's just kind of something the Yankees are going to have to deal with. And you know, I think even though it's still a month into the season, it's still really early. I get the sense that the AL East is going to be like really tight this year.
Oh yeah,
like pretty much right down to the wire. There'll be 3 or 4 teams kind of duking it out for not just a division title, but for a wild card spot too.
Yeah. Before we get into the specific stuff, I do agree with you on that, because I think each team is very clear at this point, each team's strengths and weaknesses. I think each team came out of the gate and they just, you know, made themselves known, and we're going to have each team, it's going to come down to what team can pull the guys up from the minors and which teams can pull the trades to kind of shore up those weaknesses.
And one thing that stands out right now is that no team in the division has a really strong rotation. The Rays are they have so many injuries that they got Eric Bedard and Cesar Ramos in their rotation right now. And that's usually the Rays, like somebody gets hurt, they just call up some random minor leaguer who pitches like an ace for 4 months. Mm-hmm. But that's not the way it works this year for them. And, you know, the Orioles and the Blue Jays have their rotation problems. The Red Sox, Felix DeBron is terrible. And they're just, you know, Jake Peavy's a little kind of up and down. And the Yankees, obviously, they're without Nova for the rest of the season. Pineda just got hurt. And Sabathia is not pitching well, and Kuroda's been up and down. So there's no team that, you know, you kind of go into a series matchup, you're like, this game's going to be 2-0 or, you know, 3-1, a really close game like that. This is like an offense first division right now, definitely.
And yet, it's probably the strongest division overall in baseball.
Yeah, it's definitely, I think, the deepest. You know, there's, except for maybe the Blue Jays, I don't think it would be a surprise if any of the four other teams won the division.
Yeah, that's it's a good and a bad place to be, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you just mentioned one of the big issues that the Yankees are facing early this year is that Michael Pineda, you know, he gets suspended 10 games and that sucks. And, he's just got to learn, I guess, not to be so obvious about the pine tar thing. We talk about that with Keith Law a little bit later.
Yeah, that's That's just like a learning experience for him. You know, just don't do it again, and you just kind of deal with the 10 games.
Yeah, we actually had a – it'll come on later in the show. We had an interesting discussion about the future of that kind of that rule and why it's relatively easy to change, easier than a lot of people think. But, you know, he apparently had a – you know, felt a pull in his lat during his simulated game. And he's going on the 15-day DL, but not until after his suspension's over.
Yeah, and that's just the rule. Says they got to wait for the suspension to end on Tuesday. But they said he's going to be out for 3 or 4 weeks. So he's going to be out for a month. And, you know, it's a back muscle, but it's close enough to his shoulder that you kind of worry because, you know, all the muscles work together, and that muscle's there to kind of hold the shoulder together. And after he had the surgery and missed 2 years, anything close to it makes you nervous.
I agree. But I don't think it's like a re-tear kind of scare situation. No. I just think it's perhaps the scar. There's so many issues with after surgery. There's scar tissue there. There's imbalanced muscles. There's re-strengthening of the muscles. So who knows where in the cascade something went wrong.
Right, and that's the concern is that, you know, you don't want him to hurt his shoulder compensating for this. And, because Pineda, I mean, before he got hurt, he was pitching like an ace. He was fantastic. You know, that the start against the Red Sox, the first inning was rough. And that was like his first inning of the year where he struggled. But his other three starts, he was great. The Yankees had him on a really short leash, which is completely understandable. But for those 5 or 6 innings he was out there, he was great. And it was exciting. And more in terms of the team, it was you know, good to have another pitcher that was pitching that well. Because, like I said, you know, Sabathia and Kuroda have been up and down. Nova was terrible before he got hurt, but I think the injury was a bit of a reason there. And just to have this guy after 2 years getting nothing out of him, he comes out right away and he's dominating. It was great to see. And I think now that he's going to miss this time, I mean, it could be a blessing in disguise where he gets his break now and, you know, maybe later in the season, September and October, he's a little bit more fresh. You know, that's possible, but...
Doesn't get shut down for innings, doesn't get fatigued, stuff like that.
Right.
It's good. And I agree. Said you wrote something before the season about the dream of having a young power rotation. And I wouldn't exactly say that Pineda was pitching like a power pitcher early in the season. He was sitting like 92 to 94.
Yeah.
But I mean, that slider is just devastating no matter what speed he sits at, it seems.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the equalizer for him. You know, it's just hit, you know, he doesn't really have a changeup for lefties, but a slider is so good it doesn't really matter. You know, he's not like he's just can't get lefties out at all. He just is slightly less effective against them. And, you know, you just kind of hope he comes back from the injury. He's, you know, fresh. You know, he feels good and he feels good and healthy and strong, and he can continue to pitch like that. Because I think these next 4 weeks with both Nuno and Phelps in the rotation are going to be kind of a little bit scary, you know, and you just kind of got to wait it out a little bit. Because it's too early in the season for trades, you know. As much as I would love for them to go out and get Cliff Lee, it's not realistic.
That is mention number one. It is number one. Mention number one of Cliff Lee on the River Avenue Blues podcast. We should keep a tally because we're going to mention him pretty much every episode that he's never fit better since 2010.
Right. And the thing is, he's still pitching fantastic. He's pitching like he's always pitched. Mm-hmm. But at this point, there's only a year and a half a year and 3/4 left on his contract. So you're not talking about getting this guy for the next 7 years or something. He's a rental and, you know, until the end of next year. So you get him for two playoff drives. You know, the salary isn't ridiculous. And just seems like more realistic now than it would have been maybe 2 years ago when they dumped him on waivers and the Dodgers claimed him but didn't trade for him.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, and it's not like the Phillies. If the Phillies aren't contending this year, it's not like they're going to come back and contend next year. It's not like they have a crop of guys in the upper minors. It's not like there's a free agent class that can really make a difference. It's not there. If they're going to be terrible this year, they're going to be terrible next year. That's just the way where they are as a team right now.
I agree with that completely, but I don't know if the Phillies are going to admit that and admit and say the best thing for this team to do is to trade Cliff Lee, get some prospects, trade Chase Utley, get some prospects, and rebuild. That's based on what they've done the last few years. You know, they went out and signed Burnett this winter. They signed Marlon Byrd. They're making moves that say we're trying to win, and
yeah, but if they don't, and I mean they're making short-term moves. You know, they didn't spend any draft picks. They didn't commit more than 2 years. And Marlon Byrd got what, 2 years, $8 million?
Yeah, something like that.
Oh, it was 2 years, $16 million. I'm sorry, it was $8 million per year.
Yeah,
but it's still, it's not, the Phillies have money. It's not an issue. So, if they're not, they're treading water right now. So, if they keep treading water into June, they're not trading Cliff Lee.
Yeah, and I just don't know what to. They're so unpredictable because they think they should be selling off, but they're not yet. And maybe it gets to the point where I think they have like the fourth highest payroll in baseball, the third highest. And you know, if they end up losing 95 games with that payroll, you wonder, is it going to be okay? You know, Ruben Morrow Jr. has been the GM for like 6 years now. Is it time for a change? Because we're only getting worse. And you know, that would obviously change everything if you get a new GM in there. And
yeah, because Pat Gillick built that team in the 08 team.
Sure.
Like, Pat Gillick built that team.
You know, it's similar to what happened with the Yankees back in the day. And Brian Cashman inherited Derek Jeter, Jorge Posada, Andy Pettit. He inherited those guys, and they kept winning. You know, he kept them good.
Mm-hmm.
Amaro inherited all these great players, Utley and Rollins and Cole Hamels, and they got worse. And, you know, I'm not trying to tout Cashman here. I'm just saying you can see, like, this is a situation that's happened before, and one team kept the success going, another didn't. And, you know, Gillick obviously deserves credit for, that's like one of the best stretches in franchise history because the Phillies have not been good for a while. And, you know, it seems like it's at the point where, you know, kind of start over. But, you know, admitting it is a hard thing. And I think we don't kind of, you know, owners don't want to do that stuff. You know, an owner buys a team. They don't buy a team to really make money. They buy a team because they're rich and they've always wanted to own a sports team and they want to win. And, you know, kind of admitting and starting over, like, all right, we're going to tear things down and wait 3 years and maybe be good again. It's not something a guy who owns a team is an older guy and wants to win. You know, you see in Detroit when Mike Gillick has come out and said, you know, I'm 88 years old. I want to win a title before I'm not here anymore. And when you hear it like that, it's like, it's kind of morbid, but you get his point. And I don't know if the Phillies, if they're in the same kind of situation where they want to win now, and maybe to their detriment, they just keep adding players, but we got to see. And you know what? Even if they do decide to sell, the idea of trading for Cliff Lee is still not, it's not like a slam dunk, you know, because other teams are going to want him and other teams have better prospects than the Yankees. And
every AL East team is going to be on Cliff Lee.
The Dodgers will be in on him.
I'm sorry, the Orioles won't be in on Cliff Lee because they spent a lot of money at the end of the offseason.
And you know the Rays aren't going to.
Yeah, the Rays. I should say the Yankees and the Red Sox are going to be in. Maybe the Blue Jays if they can get more players to defer their salaries.
The Dodgers will be after him. I'm sure a team like, you know, maybe the Tigers get involved, and pretty much any, you know, the Angels, if they decide to kind of make a move there, if they're still in contention, there will be competition for him. But he's, you know, he's clearly among pitchers who could reasonably be available, he's by far the best.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's not like the Detroit's going to trade Max Scherzer or Boston's going to trade John Lester or any of the upcoming free agents are going to get dealt.
Right.
So, you know, that's basically what they're dealing with right now.
Yeah, and even if these teams are open to trading these guys, they're not going to do it now. And the Yankees need their rotation help now. You know, if Pineda, if everything goes according to plan, he comes back in a month, you know, teams still won't be ready to sell then.
Yep. No. And as I talked about with Buster Olney last week, he said, you know, even in mid-July, the prices just seem to be too high. It's only when they get right to the deadline do sellers really have any motivation or impetus to make a deal.
Yeah, and I think a lot of teams are – it seems like they're very gun-shy these days where they won't – they just don't want to pay market value for a guy, you know, or it's – they don't want to give him a draft pick or something like that. They don't want to pay him the dollars. That's what happened with the Blue Jays and Irvin Santana. They didn't want to give him the extra, like, $500,000 a year, and they lost out on him. And, you know, I think you get to a point where if you have a – good chance of actually winning and going to the playoffs, you know, giving up the extra prospect is not, it shouldn't be a deal breaker because your chances of winning are so finite. But you want to, I mean, even for the Yankees with their huge payroll, you know, there's certainly chances of, you know, they had a better chance to win the World Series in 2010 than they did this year, for example. So, you want to kind of capitalize that when you can. And there's so many teams that just seem willing to say, no, we're going to hold on to everybody. And no, I'm not. I'm only going to take this guy on our price. And it kind of, it's kind of crazy to me that teams do that, but, you know, they do it.
Yeah. So, not to provide too many spoilers, but there will be mention number two of Cliff Lee later in this episode. So before we depart, Mike, I just wanted to talk about one issue, and it's been really getting to me, and I feel like a big asshole because it's getting to me. Derek Jeter's defense is a serious liability.
Yeah, and that's
like he is not even close to being a passable defensive shortstop at this point. And I know he has a lot of defenders at shortstop. You know, he holds down the fort. He makes all the plays. He's not even making all the plays that come to him at this point.
Yeah, and that's not unsurprising, though, at this point. And
no, it's not.
And then, you know, that was the problem. In the past, he just had terrible range. But if the ball was hit to Jeter, you knew he was going to turn it into an out. He's not really doing that this year. And I think Brendan Ryan's coming back probably next week, you know, within a couple of days. Jeter has not played DH at all this year. Literally zero starts at DH. And I wonder if that's going to start.
Didn't even realize that.
Yeah, and I wonder if that's going to start to change when Ryan comes back. Otherwise, I don't know what they're going to do with Ryan otherwise. And
yeah, he can't be on the D-Nana plan.
Yeah, and Steph, you could sit D-Nana on the bench for five straight games because he's D-Nana and nobody really cares. But Brendan Ryan's making kind of a decent salary. And, you know, if you're not going to put him in the field, then what's the point of having him on the roster? So I wonder if they're going to maybe give Jeter some extra DL starts. And the complicated thing with that is the outfield, because you want all four of your outfielders in the lineup all the times. And
they want to get Ichiro time out there, too.
Right. And, you know, also, the other guy who's been terrible defensively is Beltran. He's just been – it looks like he's running, like, you know, like 10%, and that's just because his knees are shot. And, you know, I think maybe it would be better if they gave him the DH time and let Soriano play right, even though Soriano hasn't really
– he has a noodle arm, though.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's a weird situation.
Yeah, it's like putting Johnny Damon in right field. Jeez.
Yeah, but, you know, I think once Brian comes back, I'm kind of interested to see how they use him. But I do think they're going to end up giving Jeter a little bit less time in the field. You know, maybe if it's just one less game a week, it's something.
Yeah, I mean, because if they have some serious designs on the World Series this year, that's something they have to address in some way. They cannot run him out there. Even five games a week seems like a bit much at this point.
But you know what? I think they'll do it anyway.
No, I don't disagree with you.
I think it's at this point they're like, it's his final season. Let's just get through this season and just, you know, we'll deal with it. And we'll worry about, you know, who's going to play shortstop next year. We'll worry about who's going to fill in then. Let's just get through this year with Jeter. And, you know, the problem is that the whole staff is ground ball pitchers. And so it really burns them a lot, but, you know, it's a very weird situation because they have this ground ball pitching staff because of the stadium, and their best defenders are all outfielders. And, you know, you kind of think maybe they should get more fly ball pitchers, but everybody's kind of scared of the home run. And it's just a very weird kind of like the way the team is built. And, you know, outside of Jeter, I think the infield defense has been okay. It hasn't been great, but.
Yeah, Roberts is okay. It's actually, the first week he seemed like he was done. I was like, oh man, this guy cannot play second base anymore. He's been better in the last few weeks.
The one thing that really stands out, but the difference between him and Cano is just their arms.
Oh yeah.
It's Roberts gets the ball that's kind of up the middle, and it's like, it's really hit or miss whether or not it's actually just going to get to first. Cano, you knew it was going to be on first, right at the first baseman's chest, and it would be an out. You know, that's fine, that's just the way it is. And Solarte's been okay at third. And
I still feel like I'd rather have Solarte play more second and Johnson at third more.
Yeah, that's
I feel like Brian Roberts is for no reason getting starts over Kelly Johnson.
Yeah, that's what the Yankees have faced a lot of lefties recently, but I still think they should. Johnson should get more playing time, and at the expense of, I mean, Roberts is the obvious guy to sit there because he just hasn't been. He's been hitting recently, but, you know, it's still not that good.
No.
And, you know, Kelly Johnson started, I think it's like four of the last 12 games. And
he had a good run. He filled in for Teixeira pretty damn well.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just kind of you know, the Yankees love their veterans, and it seems like they're just going to stick what's-his-name out, stick Roberts out there until he breaks or something, basically.
Yeah, and I said this whole situation makes me wonder, you know, exactly what they're going to do when it comes time to actually add an infielder, because they are not getting through. They're not winning this division with this current infield. I just can't see a way that happens.
Yeah, and I think it's obvious right now. They're short. Just short a player. They're short a bat, an infielder, and, they had that one extra player. And, it's a glaring need right now. And whether or not they could actually address it, you know, trading for help isn't as easy as it once was. And but obviously, the thing is that they have the flexibility on the infield with Johnson and Solarte, that they could get a second baseman or a third baseman, depending on who's available there. They can make it work. They're not pigeonholed into getting this one specific position, and maybe they'll make life a little easier when it comes time to talk about a trade.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. And kind of reflecting as we've talked about the Yankees on this episode, is that they're doing fairly well. They're in first place in the division. They've been winning generally, as much as we've expected, if not more. And we're looking ahead to the trade deadline to shore up the weaknesses already, and it's just we just got through the first month of the season. So I think that speaks pretty well of where the Yankees stand right now, is that, everyone's mostly satisfied. It's not like, the Yankees looking for huge overhauls and they need so much if they're going to contend. It's the Yankees are good. They have some weaknesses. They need to shore them up, and that's what we're talking about, because there's less to talk about when a team's good.
Yeah, and it's fun to talk about, too. Everybody likes talking about trades and whatever, I think the Yankees, they had a really good I thought April went pretty well. They had this like weird stretch where every game was a blowout and they were on the wrong end of some of those, and then it just made the month kind of look weird because they were giving up so many runs and stuff like that. But they're on top of the division right now, and even though that doesn't mean much right now, it's better than being stuck, in last place and having to look up four games or whatever.
Yeah, you don't have to make up the ground, and now you can, they're more able to absorb the pitching injuries they just sustained because they had, they gave themselves a cushion.
And one thing I think is kind of important is, remember last year they got off to a really good start, but that always felt like it was not supposed to happen.
Oh,
like,
no.
We were waiting for the other shoe to drop with Wells and Hafner and guys like that. And this team is good because the players are good. Like, I don't expect Jacoby Ellsbury to fall off a cliff, or Carlos Beltran maybe 37, but I'm still pretty sure he's going to rake. Teixeira's looked good. The one guy who has not done anything yet is McCann.
And he's going, he's not bad.
No, and I think the one thing I noticed was that he has like the highest infield pop-up rate in the league. And it's like so far out of line with the rest of his career, and like everything else is the same. He's actually striking out way less than he ever has before, and that's like the one real thing that sticks out, is he's popping up so many pitches in general. And I see that, and I think he's like just missing, and he's on the cusp of just putting it all together and starting to hit.
And he's not.
Once that happens, there'll be so much. The lineup will just be so much deeper.
And he's not shooting for – it's not like he's shooting for the short porch either, like a lot of lefties do when they come to Yankee Stadium for the first time. He's going the other way a fair amount.
Yeah, there was that game in Fenway Park. He went 3-for-4, 3-for-5, whatever it was. He was 3-for-4. All three hits were to the opposite field, and he also had two other line drives that he hit foul. And I was like, what's going on here? Because I'm waiting for him to pull the ball to right field, and everything was to left field, and – so maybe that's part of it. Maybe he's just trying to go the other way too much, and he's kind of in a funk there. But once he starts going, starts giving them something, because right now he's getting nothing. And once he gives them something, it'll lengthen the lineup, and things will just be so much better. And it seems like there's always this one guy every year who kind of goes through that, and it just so happens to be McCann this year. And I think he's done an okay job with the pitching staff, better than okay.
Right? Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's been a big difference for him.
Yeah, so that's, it's not like he's doing nothing, Yeah. So it's working out there.
Yep. So, Mike, it was good to get the old lineup back together, it's good to have a flexible lineup at the new RAB podcast.
Yes, I agree completely. I love I love getting the interviews now.
Yeah, because coming up just after the break, we're going to have Jay and I are going to sit down with Keith Law of ESPN.
Welcome back to the River Avenue Blues podcast. This is Jay, and of course I've got Joe here with me. And joining us as a special guest today, we've got Keith Law, who is the senior baseball analyst for the ESPN Insider. Keith, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Doing great.
Better than the Northeast.
Yes.
Yeah, it's for you.
With the game being canceled today, because we are recording this on Wednesday, we felt it was a good time to kind of discuss a little bit of Yankees, talk about some of the things that are going on. And, of course, we wanted to get started with a question that I think has been pretty prevalent around people nowadays since the recent Red Sox-Yankees game, which is the everyone does it is okay culture that's gone around getting extra grip on the ball. What are your thoughts about that?
So, you know, my initial thought was, look, that's BS, right? He's trying to cheat. I mean, we go back to the Joe Niekro and Kevin Gross and Mike Scott. Like, this shit's been going on for forever, so it doesn't surprise us. Then Alan Nathan, you guys probably follow him on Twitter, the physics of baseball guy. Mm-hmm. He had an interesting set of quotes. I think it might have been on SI.com where he's like, no, this is legit. Mm-hmm. There's a very legitimate reason why a pitcher would want something to improve his grip on the ball, and that it could actually not just improve it's not so much about improving the movement on the ball, but just his ability to grip it so that he can throw it for strikes.
Yeah.
So that to me kind of, you know, my initial reaction was clearly wrong, too extreme, that, you know, maybe it's more like, well, baseball probably has to come up with some kind of compromise here that on a cold night, there's a way for a pitcher to be able to improve his grip on the ball without doing something that clearly breaks the rules. Because what Pineda did was against the rules. I was going to say wrong, but it shouldn't be judgmental. It's like, look, these are the rules. And Farrell, to his credit, they kind of let it go the first time. And then the second time, it's like, well, it's on the side of your neck. What the hell am I going to do?
Mm. So do you think rule change is more than likely? Or do you find that basically the game's kind of just poorly policing itself? And when I say the game, I mean by the veterans that are playing with a guy like Pineda.
Yeah, I think it's – I mean, you guys tell me what you think. I just think we don't get a lot of rule changes. You know, something bad has to happen. Like the fact that they changed the transfer rule or fixed the transfer rule as fast as they did, mm-hmm. I was floored. I figured they'd just say, well, we'll appoint a committee after the season and take a look at it.
Blue ribbon committee on the transfer rule.
Right? Yeah. So with the pine tar or whatever you want to call it, the grip question, mm-hmm. I mean, is there an impetus to look at it? Some GM would have to stand up at the GM meetings in November and say, hey, we got to do something about this. Does anybody have the incentive to do that? Maybe Cashman does now because he's pissed off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I don't know.
Well, I think there's an important point to make here is that it's pine tar. It's not Crisco. It's not Vaseline. It's not KY jelly or anything that Harris used to get up to more movement on the ball. And
well,
I think
use Crisco because that's illegal in New York, thanks to Bloomberg, right?
No trans fats for us.
Right.
So that's to be the most difficult part of making a new rule about it is how do you determine what they can use and what they can't use, and how do you police that then?
Right. Well, you know, giving more judgment calls to umpires is something I think we're all in favor of.
I don't know if we want to give them any more work to do. It seems like they're just so overwhelmed lately. So moving on from the pine tar topic, of course, as a Yankees fan, and that's what we are over on our side, we've been able to watch Masahiro Tanaka make some starts and really impress overall, even with his last start and obviously with not his best stuff, went out there, pitched a pretty respectable game for a guy who's, you know, still pretty new to the league. What are your thoughts on Tanaka, and do you feel like he's better than expected?
Yeah, I'd say he's maybe a grade, half a grade better than expected so far, but with the caveat that for a guy who's, you know, typically a free agent changes teams in MLB. There's not so much of the, well, no one's ever seen him before. Well, everyone's got to adjust to him. I don't know to what extent the second, third time around there will be an adjustment. All right, now we've seen him pitch a couple times. Hitters get used to the delivery, the release point, picking up the ball. I mean, that said, what's coming out of his hand is pretty good. It's a plus splitter. It's, you know, it's one of those, like, reminds me of when Hideo Nomo first came over, and it was, it doesn't matter if you pick the ball up. You have to learn to, hitters have to be able to not swing at that pitch because it's diving out of the zone so frequently. He can throw it 2-3 times in a row. They're still chasing it. You know, if they just, it could take them years to pick up. And Nomo had a, at least a good 2 years before hitters finally started to lay off. I think he called it a fork ball, but it was the principle's the same. And if Tanaka is throwing strikes with the fastball and can get ahead and gets hitters to continue chasing that splitter, why couldn't he, you know, continue to pitch at this level or close to this level for the rest of the season? Mm-hmm. It's not like it's all deception. This is not a, it's not a smoke and mirrors thing at all. He's got legitimately good shit.
Yeah. One question I had posed to me by someone, or a question posed in general to, by someone, they wondered if this was a trend for the Yankees to start taking a look at more international players, and if they are, have they just kind of changed their perception on what they're seeing from these international guys, or have they just gotten better in the scouting?
I mean, they scout pretty heavily internationally, and it's, I mean, that's true on the major league free agent side, and I mean, also on the internationals, the July 2nd guys, too. I think we've all seen the reports. They're going to blow out their international budget, and that's kind of, I mean, that's what they should do, right? This, they've got the best, the most resources of any club, at least in the American League, maybe of any club. Mm-hmm. You sort of expect them to see them exercise that muscle in international markets, and that's the one place, Japan, Korea, Cuba, where you, there's no limit. You can spend pretty much whatever you want. It's not covered by any of these silly, you know, draft caps, international bonus pools, whatever. I mean, they should be, if they want one of those players, it should probably by and large come down to them and the Dodgers in most situations, where they shouldn't be outbid on money. They may choose, all right, we've scouted this guy, we don't think he's a good fit for our ballpark, but they shouldn't be losing out on these guys just because they're not willing to spend the cash anymore. And I don't think they will. I think the fact that they've really clicked on one for the first time will encourage them to explore those markets again.
Yeah, and I have a, kind of a follow-up on that is, do you think that the international guys who aren't subject to any of the caps, do you think they – it seems like they do, but I just wanted to make sure that this is the perception of the industry, that they have kind of a leverage now that they didn't have before to get that 40-man spot, because they know that they're a commodity that, that's not capped and they're not like the other guys, you know, guys defecting from Cuba and guys particularly – you know, the younger guys like Diaz, the guy that signed with the Cardinals. It was Diaz, right?
Adinius Diaz.
Yeah, Diaz.
Monica, try the first name.
Adamus, yeah. I tried.
A Diaz, like A Martinez, right? Just the A dot, yeah. Yes, to answer your question, yes, absolutely. I hear that in the industry all the time. It's not – it's even more than that. It's more than just the leverage for the major league contract and the 40-man spot, but it's also that they can get clauses in their contracts like – I have the option to opt out of the deal and go to arbitration instead. I have the option to – some of the Japanese players have had this in the past. After 3 years, you know, it's a three-year contract and you can't offer me arbitration afterwards. So it's sort of a forced free agency before the six-year period. Those players, the best ones were able to get it before the new CBA. Now I think they can pretty much all get at least some of those – incentives, some of those extra terms, because that's, again, it's the only place you can spend freely now at this point if you want to try to improve your club. And I think we're going to see lesser players coming over from – it's really those three countries in particular who get more. And it may not be so much that they get more money than we think they should get, but if people were to dig on the contracts, really, you gave that guy an arbitration opt-out clause? Well, yeah, because, you know, what the heck else were we going to do? It was our only way to get him.
Yeah, and it seems like with guys coming over from Korea now, that I know there's a big report about a guy, a third baseman from Korea that plans to play in the majors next year.
I checked on him. Granted, I talked to one scout, so you know, don't take this to the bank. But I forwarded the report and said, "What do you got on this guy?" And he was like, "That guy's terrible. He's not even a utility fielder. He's not." So it's, I guess maybe it's safe to say there is a wide range of opinions on that player. He was Heyman had a quote calling him the David Wright of Korea, which may be a comment on his celebrity, not on his baseball ability. Oh, but apparently, he's not quite that kind of hitter.
All right, that's a clickable headline right there, though.
Yeah, it is. Oh, absolutely. I clicked. Absolutely.
I think we all did. And yeah, it was like, you know, not much information really on the guy at all, which is, you know, why you got to start asking around, because the information we get about these guys, it seems like that in the public realm, there's just an international guys. There's just not too much information.
And no, there's not. And the, you know, the stats. I mean, you look, obviously you want to see, there's some basic things you want to see. I don't care what level he's at. If it's a pitcher, I want to make sure he's striking guys out. It's a hitter, I'd like to make sure he takes an occasional walk. But really the variance in the competition that they're facing in those leagues makes it so hard to evaluate them statistically. And the scouting reports, like you said, the stuff that's public is very limited. It's not even easy to find I don't find it's easy to find sources on that, because there are a lot of teams that just, no, we don't do the Pacific Rim at all. There's some clubs that are just not there, or they'll say, well, we only scout Japan, we don't scout Korea. Oh, we only scout those two, but we don't scout Taiwan. So it's tricky. I'm glad there's only like one or two of them a year, because if there were 10 of them, I don't think I have the time or the energy to chase all that stuff down.
So speaking of, let's get into talking about prospects and specifically the Yankees. 2013 was kind of a new draft class where they had a little bit more as far as high level picks. And when I say high level, it's tough to really call them high, but they certainly weren't, you know, just second and third round. But how do you feel the 2013 draft class compares to, you know, ones that they've been really heavily criticized about in years prior?
Well, they had the first round pick. They had three round picks, and most years they hadn't had one, which I think is what you're talking about, drafting high for them. And I loved what they did with those first three. They took, I thought, a high probability college position player in Eric Jagielo, who's now in Tampa. They took a high ceiling, kind of high risk, high reward type college position player in Aaron Judge, who I just saw in playing in Lakewood, but he's with Charleston. And then they took Ian Clarkin, I thought a fairly high ceiling high school left-handed pitcher from Southern California, which we know Damon Oppenheimer likes those Southern California kids, with the third pick. So it was a good mixture. It's a good way. You've got three picks all in proximity in the same range of the draft to kind of mix it up like a portfolio. We got some probability, but we went for some ceiling. We got two position players. We got a pitcher. You know, but imagine in the Yankees draft room, we don't get a lot of chances like this. So let's try to maximize our return here. Let's go for it and try to fill a couple of different holes at once, which I thought made a ton of sense. I loved seeing those picks for them. And it was a good shift away from, you know, the Cito Culver, Dante Bichette. Was clearly not off for them.
Mm-hmm. So you brought up Aaron Judge, and he's kind of a sexy topic that you could go with, because, I mean, he's a big guy. Yeah. Everybody in baseball loves size. They love, you know, a big dude. And from his tool set, was there anything that stood out and impressed you?
He's big. Like, he would be the largest regular outfielder in major league history, I think, if he gets there. And I mean, he will. I think he'll get there. But he's actually a good athlete for his size. He runs fine. He's at least average, maybe a tick above. He throws well. I saw him play center in college. I didn't think he was a center fielder in pro ball, but he wasn't terrible out there. I think he'll be above average in right. The crazy thing about him, and you know, forgive me, I'm sure you guys have seen me write some of this before, but he'll show you huge power in BP. Mm-hmm. He's big. He's got, you know, he gets comped to Stanton because of the size, and because he's got the good follow through, and gets, I mean, it's huge, huge power in BP. In the game, he's actually pretty short to the ball, just from when he loads to where he gets the barrel of the bat into the zone. And I think he changes his approach in the game too, to not strike out. I'm just going to make a lot of hard contact. So it's line drives. It's not huge power. I don't think he's going to hit 25 bombs for Charleston this year, but you see a guy with that size, with limbs like that, you think, oh, he's going to strike out 180 times. I don't think he's that kind of hitter. I think he's actually going to be a better hitter for contact, at least for now, and maybe show a little less power. And then the hope for the Yankees is that as he matures as a hitter, they can kind of get him to a point where he can make that adjustment on the fly. All right, now I can drive. I'll lengthen things out a little bit.
Yeah. So the three guys you mentioned, the guys from the first round, are probably – at least for the time being, on the path to actually play on the Yankees. We know that can change at any time, but I wouldn't think Cashman inclined to trade any of them this deadline. But have you seen or heard of developing the guys that, well, basically, without rambling, which of the guys in the system do you think will bring the Yankees the most value at the trade deadline, since they're looking at needing a pitcher and probably an infielder?
I mean, they have actually some surplus, or at least some strength, I should say, in the system in catching. And I think the currency value of those guys, and I'm thinking specifically of J.R. Murphy and Gary Sanchez, but that's not all. There's such a shortage of catching around baseball. Those guys are going to return them more, relatively speaking, than comparable at other positions. I think they can go out into the market because the system is not that strong overall for the trade market. But if Cashman goes out there and says, look, I'm willing to talk about all the minor league catching, he's going to get a better response. He'll be able to make a move for either of those things you said you needed, headlining a package with one of the catchers. It would help if scouts liked Sanchez's receiving more. I think he's gotten better. It is very much a matter of what night you see him, though. You could go in and watch him for 2-3 games and think he's got no shot to catch. You could watch him the next 3 games and think, oh, this guy's absolutely, you know, he can stay there. He's an average catcher with a plus arm. It's not like Jesus Montero where nothing plays. It's just there are days there. Montero, my favorite quote was, oh, he's got a great arm. Just takes him an hour and a half to get rid of the ball. Sanchez isn't like that. Sanchez can actually let it go, and I think he likes showing it off. I just wish he liked showing off the other parts of the catching game too. But, you know, that's how it is. There's 29 other teams that will scout Trenton, and they'll have different reports. Sanchez. Some pro scouts will put him in and say he can't catch, and some will say, yeah, he can catch. And by the way, that's an enormous bat for the position. And those are the clubs where, in Cashman's situation, I mean, maybe it makes sense. Maybe they figure we've got McCann and Sanchez is, you know, hasn't moved as fast as we thought. Maybe we make a move with him now to one of those clubs that looks at Sanchez and says, this is a franchise catcher for us.
So with that, obviously, you just did get to see both the Yankees and Phillies Sally League. And obviously, there's a potential matchup maybe there. I think that you could say that in a deal for a guy like Cliff Lee, the Yankees had the financial wherewithal to take on the money. And I mean, you could say that the prospects that they have right now could potentially match up.
I agree. I do think so. I think the Phillies need guys who are closer to the big league, certainly. And if they were to go in and see that Trenton club, could they value Gary Sanchez? I mean, they need catching. They don't have catching that's close to the majors. All the Phillies catching prospects are further away. That would be a fit. Would they like a guy like Aaron Judge? High ceiling, high reward. That's how the Phillies have evaluated players. They tend to go from a more traditional scouting-oriented perspective. I think they'd like Judge. They might like Mason Williams, too, who's just really athletic. It's more of a makeup and work ethic issue to sort of put it all together. Mm-hmm. But the Phillies haven't minded taking guys like that in trade or in the draft necessarily. So, yeah, I could see a couple different ways it would line up. The only way that it wouldn't line up is if the Phillies said, well, we need a pitcher. We need a quality pitcher in the deal. And obviously the Yankee system is much, much stronger on the position player side.
Which was a rarity in the last few years because it felt like they were completely bereft of any position players for quite a while. So I think we're going to wrap it up, Keith. And obviously, one of the things that you're well known for on Twitter and obviously in your blogging is discussion of food and cooking and such. And I won't deny that I myself am more of a grilling guy. So which is your preference? Are you a gas or a charcoal guy?
Charcoal for the grill and, of course, gas stove in the kitchen.
Okay.
I miss having that question. I really miss having the gas range. Having the electric, it just doesn't cook the same.
Oh, it's so annoying. Well, plus, like, I've cooked with gas for so long, and we bought the house here in Delaware in the fall, and we knew going in we were going to have to redo the kitchen. But for now, it's an electric stove, and, like, I forget that the stupid thing stays hot.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, I mean, it's stupid, but it's force of habit. And I turn around and it's like, oh, what's that? Oh shit. I just burned something because it doesn't cool off. Like I turned it off. It's supposed to be off now, but I've obviously trained my brain, or I'm just getting old now. And I just totally space out. And yeah, I did that last night. My wife is like, what is that? I'm like, oh, I left the pan on the burner thinking, well, I turned the burner off. Good enough. Right? No. So yeah, we're going to get that place because I'm too stupid to figure it out, apparently.
I recently moved last year from a place with an electric range to gas. And once I had a gas range again, I was much happier. Plus, in my current place, I'm allowed to have a grill on my balcony. And, like, I'm a charcoal guy through and through. Had a beer can chicken running this past weekend and came out pretty close. Still needs a little work because the breast meat was a little dry. But that's a tough one to kind of get through.
Yeah. It's, you know what I want to experiment more with, and I'm going to have to since we're not going to have a kitchen for a couple weeks, is actually grilling with or smoking with hardwoods. Like I've done the mix where you do the charcoal and you put hardwood on top of it. And then readers, of course, I get, you know, the scolding on Twitter. Well, that's not really smoking, you know. So it's, I'm not like a true smoker crowd. I'm a true smoker guy, so I got to try that.
I'm the same way. I use a Weber kettle, and I just throw some wood on top of my charcoal and try to smoke it out. But, you know, you sometimes you got to do what you got to do. So,
yeah, exactly. I make no apologies.
Absolutely. So, Keith, want to thank you a lot for coming on. Everybody can find you on Twitter at Keith Law. And there's anything else you'd like to remind our listeners?
You know, since I know you guys are prospect oriented on the site, and I've been getting a lot of questions. When's the next draft update? Looks like May 8th will be the next draft ranking, and then the week after that, I'll actually start doing mock first rounds. Which, maybe not quite as of interest to Yankee fans this year, but you know, you can see who may not be available.
Great, sounds great.
Thanks a lot, Keith. We appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure.
I'm here with Tommy Rensell. He writes for ESPN's Sweet Spot blog, The Process Report. It's a must-read for anybody who's a fan of the AL East because you guys cover the Rays in a way that kind of we aspired to cover Rab from the beginning. You cover the Yankees with Rab. And you also write for Peter Gammons' site, Gammons Daily.
Yeah, I'm trying to bring a little bit of balance to the the Boston favoritism that we see there. So trying to infiltrate the get behind enemy lines.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I kind of never saw something like that coming because, it was such a big surprise when he left ESPN for MLB Network. And then I guess he's at the point where, screw it, he can do what he wants.
Yeah, and it didn't come with the fanfare of all these other, I guess, satellite sites that are, spin-offs of major sites. He's kind of doing it on his own, and I have fun doing it. He's been great. I think it's rare for a guy like him to give back. He has no reason to do any of it, but he's giving us a platform, and it's been fun.
Yeah, that's like I said, it's a quality read. It's a nice little it's quite I find it quite different than most of what you're going to find even like the SB Nation MLB blog, which is one of my regular reads. It stands out. It's just not just your general baseball blog. All right. So, but we are talking Rays today. And the one thing that the Yankees and the Rays played a couple weeks ago, and I think plenty has changed for both teams since then. The one thing that seems to be really killing the Rays right now, they lost Matt Moore for the season. And is Alex Cobb on his way back?
Yeah, it looks like, he's begun his throwing program. When you have that oblique lat muscle, on the side, it's really important that you get that correct, because if you come back too early or you try to rush things, you're looking at turning a 6-week injury, into a 2 or 3 month injury and going into later in the summer. So he's starting his throwing program. Jeremy Hellickson, I believe, threw off a mound for the first time. So looking to get those guys back, in some order, Cobb, Hellickson, maybe towards the end of this month, if not the beginning of June.
That's not a terrible timeline. Who's been filling in for those guys in the interim?
Well, Jake Odorizzi won the fifth starter spot that was vacated by Hellickson, and then you had Moore and Cobb within a span of a week, and with that you had the other guys who were competing with Odorizzi, Eric Bedard and Cesar Ramos are now in the rotation. Ramos began the year in the bullpen. Bedard was released at the end of spring training, couldn't find a major league gig, went to Durham, made one start, and was called up initially to serve in the bullpen. But then Cobb got hurt and he got pressed into the role. So it's, you're looking at the depth chart. If Odorizzi was the sixth starter after Hellickson, Cesar Ramos the seventh, Bedard the eighth, Alex Colome, who could have factored in there, was suspended to begin the season. He got a 50-game suspension for PEDs. You know, he probably would have been in there ahead of Bedard, so maybe you push Bedard to ninth. So, they're really stretching the limits of the depth. I know it's been something that they pride themselves on, but I'm sure they really didn't want to use it this much this soon.
Yeah, I remember talking to your partner in crime, RJ Anderson, when Colome got suspended. Because Yankees fans remember him. He pitched a gem against the Yankees last summer. And, and RJ didn't seem to think it was a big deal at the time, but obviously a couple weeks later, he would have, it just seems to me he's probably a better option than Bedard at this point.
Yeah, and maybe they would have popped him in for Ramos too. But yeah, it, at the time, it didn't seem like a big deal because you had Moore and Cobb in there. I mean, losing Hellickson, obviously a quality major league pitcher, even though he had a down season. So, you figure losing one guy is okay. Colome was another guy, but then when you go and you lose your number two and three guys, it kind of magnifies things. And yeah, now it would have been a spot where, Colome may have been up. Who knows what he does? Maybe he does something to stick around. And especially with Moore being out all year, there's going to be a spot left open. So, but yeah, he kind of wasted that opportunity.
Yeah, and it looks like the Rays kind of lucked out in that they get David Price to start the series with the Yankees. So at least they start off on their strongest foot.
Yeah, and Price has been kind of up and down. The ERA is high, but we know that can be misleading. He's not walking guys, which is something he's been doing ever since he came back from the DL. The thing with Price, it's been magnified over these last couple of weeks, is even when he's not on his game, he's going to give you, at least six innings. Right now, these replacements are struggling to go five. It's putting a lot of tax on the bullpen. So at least with Price, you expect quality. But even if not, he's going to give you some quantity in terms of innings.
Yeah. And then the bullpen, you said, that was a strong point coming into the season. Did moving Ramos out to the rotation, how is that kind of, has that made it significantly worse, or are they still holding down the fort?
No, I think, I think considering what they've been asked to do, they've been holding down the fort. It's just a lot of innings. And when you're asking your guys, and we saw it on Easter against the Yankees, they pitch really well for about seven innings. And then, when you're starting to ask them to pitch that eighth inning of work, and as you go down in innings, the quality of reliever usually goes down because you're using your better guys up front to keep the game close. So I think that's plagued them more than anything. If you look at, the quality of the bullpen in a normal game situations when they've been able to, asked to carry a normal workload, they've been fine. It's when they've been stretched thin or overworked, it's going to happen. Those guys are not used to, that kind of heavy workload, especially so early. So I think, when starters come back, when the team starts to get healthy, I think the bullpen will ultimately be fine. It's just, they've been taxed pretty hard early on.
Yeah, and I said it's really hard to not like their setup and closing crew, with Jake McGee, who just, the guy impresses. I know he's a little inconsistent at times, but who in the bullpen isn't? And then Joel Peralta and Grant Belfour was one of the – I love the signing myself.
Yeah, he's been a little erratic, but, that's kind of the nature. He's kind of erratic on and off the field. He's kind of an unstable guy, so – I think Jake McGee is great. A lot has been made about, adding a second pitch, but when you can throw 98 and you can command it, you have several different pitches right there because you can throw it high, you can throw, you can do what you want with it. So it becomes several pitches unto itself, and he's added a little bit of a curveball. Joel Peralta, I just love because this is a guy who barely throws 90. He can get lefties and righties out. He's a bulldog out there. He wants the ball in tough situations. So I think once things get, if you can get to a point where your guys are going six innings consistently and you're turning the ball to those guys, and then, Juan Oviedo, former Leo Nunez, get him back into the mix. He had a rough outing his last time, but this is second or third time pitching since 2011. So he's just getting his arm back under him. And, Heath Bell has been okay. He got roughed up one time, but it was on his 44th pitch or something like that. You really don't want that guy throwing that many pitches. So I think it's just a matter of the starters will help the bullpen. It'll be a chain effect.
Yeah. It's funny what you said about Bell because the last time he pitched well against the Yankees his last time out. But his ERA looked terrible. And, people love to make fun of Heath Bell. So you see that and you think he's terrible. But I don't think most, I didn't know, and I don't think most people knew that it was one bad appearance on a long, long appearance.
Yeah, he, you know, with his replacement starters, a lot of guys, I think he threw 57 pitches within 2 days. You know, guy, this is a guy who's used to being a one inning guy, maybe a couple times a week. So, you know, a lot of guys have been asked to do that, and you know, they've pretty much responded well, but, you know, there's going to be spots where, you know, their effectiveness fades just because they don't have that kind of endurance.
Yeah. So the offense for the Rays, that was, I know a lot of, I don't know if it was a general thing or just the ESPN guys. I love to listen to the Baseball Tonight podcast with Buster Olney. And he and his frequent guests were just lauding the Rays offense coming into this year. And like most of the AL East, they've kind of migrated towards the middle of the pack. They're kind of down with a little bit below average, the league average in runs scored with the Yankees and the Red Sox. So from an offensive standpoint, what has been the biggest thing that hasn't reached expectations yet?
I think it's been left-handed pitching, you know, going against left-handed pitching, and which is weird because this lineup tends to skew right-handed. When you look at guys who are going to be in there every day, like Evan Longoria, Will Myers, Desmond Jennings, you know, Escobar, both catchers are right-handed. So you're very heavy on the right-handed side. So you would think that would bode well against lefties, but it hasn't. And the hired guns like Sean Rodriguez and Logan Forsythe, guys who are starting primarily against left-handed pitching, really haven't done anything. So I think that's kind of weighing the offense down. They face a lot of lefties. So, you know, even within the division with, you know, the guys on the Yankees and they're facing DuBron tonight, Burley over on the Jays. So I think that's part of it. And I think this team, you know, they've shifted from the days where Carlos Pena and BJ Upton, which were, you know, the guys who take walks but also strike out a lot. You look at this lineup, he's really not a guy who's going to be there on a nightly basis that's going to be that high strikeout guy. They've shifted more to a contact mode. And with that, you know, they're hitting into a lot of double plays. You know, they're in the bottom, I think, five of hitting double plays, that, you know, so that's just kind of the downfall of, you know, contact hitting, is that when guys are on base, you hit that, you roll that ball over to shortstop, it's going to be two outs, where a strikeout, one out, and you keep moving. So I think those two things, you know, nobody's really hitting, you know, out of their mind. Maybe Matt Joyce is the one guy that's hitting a little bit above, you know, his career norms. But you know, I like his approach. I think there's some, you know, tangible stuff to his hot start. So I think it's just a combination of guys not hitting up to par. I think Will Myers has struggled a little bit. Then the struggles versus the lefties, and you know, some bad luck on these double play balls.
Yeah, hasn't Joyce? Correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't he typically a fast starter? I remember a couple times he just had ridiculous numbers early in the season.
Yeah, he's earned the nickname Month of May because May is usually the month where he just goes off. And then he kind of cools off from there. I guess he got it started early, and you know, hopefully he can continue on. But he's doing you know, some things at the plate. He's not chasing. He's kind of using the opposite field. He's shooting balls to left field more. He's been primarily a pull guy, so he's starting to use that the other portion of the field. And again, when he's tightening his strike zone, not swinging at balls, I think, you know, those are just good things to do.
Yeah. So do you think that that once the Rays do get the pitching thing corrected, that when they get Cobb, you know, because Cobb's going to be back, and it stands to reason. I mean, we've seen lat injuries get really bad, as, you know, Roy Halladay kind of ended his career almost. But, you know, Cobb's injury isn't expected to be nearly that bad. So when he comes back, and then with Hellickson back, do you think that the Rays will kind of even out and correct the maladies that have led them to the cellar so far?
Yeah, that's the hope. I mean, you're looking at maybe four or five more turns, you know, 20, 25 games through until these guys come back, and you just kind of want to stay within that four, you know, that right now they started tonight, four games back, you know, with a chance to close it. I think if they win, you know, against the Red Sox tonight, they could be at third place, whatever that means right now. But, you know, they're still in the pack. So I think if they can just kind of, you know, tread water till they get their guys back. I mean, you know, you really don't appreciate quality starting pitching until you don't have it. I mean, when you're hoping to get five innings a night from some of these guys, it's, you know, it really puts an emphasis on, wow, you know, what they could have had if everybody would have stayed healthy from the start, where you had guys, you know, capable of going six, seven innings, allowing two or three runs, you know, to the point now where it's like, well, hopefully we can get five and we'll see what happens. So once that happens, you know, hopefully they can correct this month, maybe reverse it, but just stay the course right now, kind of stay within it, and then see when everybody gets back, if you can push forward.
Yeah, and I feel like that's the biggest thing, especially for the Rays. Mike and I were just talking about, and we spent an entire like segment of the show talking about, oh, what the Yankees can do with the deadline. You know, it's May 1st. And I feel like the Rays just, they don't have that because they don't have the payroll. Like, we're talking about the Yankees having the payroll to take on Cliff Lee. So I guess it's when the Rays fans look forward to midseason upgrades, it's more from the guys in the minors, right?
Yeah, and that was, you know, last year looking at Will Myers and Chris Archer, who came up
in the season.
Yeah, and those were the, you know, the midseason acquisition. Alex Torres, who's now in San Diego, was another guy who came up and was just nails out of the bullpen. So this year it looks like it's going to come from the disabled list. I mean, it's going to come hopefully a little bit earlier than the deadline, but, you know, you're looking, if you can get through April and May and be kind of around that 500 mark, then you're getting back Hellickson, Cobb. You know, you're getting back two guys who are middle of the rotation or better starters. You know, they're not going to get that elsewhere. So you're looking at those guys, and maybe towards the end of the season, you bring up a guy like Eni Romero, or maybe Alex Colomé, you know, get some work done, and maybe you bring those guys in, you know, as bullpen guys, as, you know, just additional arms. Because when we get to August, you start to get, you know, start to get that fatigue factor. So maybe you can, you know, use one of those guys as a spot start. And then having just Will Myers all year is another acquisition in itself.
Yeah. As I said, I feel like the Rays, you know, they're in that position where they're not totally screwed because they're waiting for the DL rather than being able to add payroll and make moves, because they were pretty heavily favored to win the AL East coming into the season. I think any prediction other than the Rays to win the division was kind of a truly bold prediction. But, you know, you figure all they really lost was more. So everything else is in line.
Yeah, and I think most of those predictions were based on the starting pitching being so deep. And, you know, Chris Archer started the season as the number four guy. He is now the number two guy. He's obviously pitched much better than your regular four, but if the plan was to have that guy pitching as well as he is as your four, obviously, you know, things are going well in the front three spots. So I think that was, you know, pretty much what everybody was basing, you know, their predictions on. And if they can get Cobb back and Hellickson back, you know, losing more is obviously going to, you know, damage the depth a little bit. But I think they have enough to absorb one starter going down. It's just been the three starters that's been a problem.
It has. Well, thanks for coming on, Tommy. It was really a pleasure talking to you. And everyone, make sure to check out The Process Report. That's theprocessreport.net. And it's The Process Report, correct?
Correct.
Theprocessreport.net. You can read Tommy. You can read RJ Anderson and Jason Collette. They're both fans of River Avenue Blues as well. And with that, this edition of the River Avenue Blues podcast comes to a close. Thanks again to Keith Law and Tommy Rancel. For Mike and Jay, I'm Joe, and we will talk to you on Monday.